This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Welcome to another Joy 94.9 podcast. This podcast is a summary of the weekly program. Due to copyright restrictions, the music has been edited to make this podcast possible.
Hello and welcome to the Outland Institute, the pop culture show where two men enter, one man leaves. Yes, we nearly killed someone last week, but I'll tell you more about that later. On today's show, we have... Oh, look, it's packed full. It's packed full of stars. It's Judith Lucy, Australia's top comedian, will be in for a very extensive interview where we talk about success. What is it? Where does it go? And whence? We also have a very special presenter of Crimes Against Pop this week. I'm not going to say exactly who he is, but he's an ex-soap star. You'll probably know him. And he was in a band. And if he was testing his microphone, he might go, check, 1, 2.
Dieter Brummer!
It's not Dieter Brummer. We also have Narelle M. Harris looking at books you may care to purchase for Christmas. Glenn Dunks will be looking back on Australian film this year. The good, the bad, and the potentially fatal. Joining us in the studio unofficially is Josh Canal from the TV podcast Box Cutters.
Hello, unofficially.
Hello, Josh Canal. And yes, and the first song in today's musical challenge was The Waitresses with I Know What Boys Like, because I do have my cat moves. Have you seen my cat moves?
I've not seen your cat moves.
Very good.
Do boys like atonal songs?
They love them.
Right.
That's what boys really dig.
Right. Yeah. I'll note that down. Atonal songs. Yeah. So I'm going to guess.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to guess based on that one song.
Yeah, based on the one song. What connects all the songs I'm playing based on the one song
I've I've never gotten this right.
No, it's surprising. That isn't that guessing for the one song.
I'm a little bit bitter. So I'm going to say, John, that today's musical challenge is... songs with a spurious connection to each other combined on a list to test your audience.
Wow. That's actually the correct answer.
I win, Dieter Brummer!
there is actually, though, a more specific answer I'm looking for.
Right.
On top of that. But well done you. That is the closest you've ever got.
That is the... It's possibly my last chance.
Yeah.
But also the closest stuff. Well, that makes me happy. Hey, you know what? Right. I really want to talk about TV.
All right, but you know, you can't talk about TV until I press this button.
I know.
Joining me officially in the studio to talk television... it's Josh Canal.
Hi, John Richards.
Hey, Josh Canal.
Now, last night I watched some old episodes of Twilight Zone.
Oh, okay. Yeah. This is black and white Twilight Zone we're talking about?
Black and white Rod Serling Twilight Zone.
Not mid-80s colour Twilight Zone.
No, but I was inspired by something that recently happened, which is a movie is coming out called The Box.
Yeah.
Which is based on a mid-80s Twilight Zone episode.
If you listen to the show, you'd already know about
that. Well, I'm just saying,
we discussed it some weeks back.
Some people might not be aware.
No, they don't. Everyone listens to every episode from beginning to end.
Not me.
Intently.
Not me.
But you're right.
I get the musical challenge more. Anyway.
But tell us.
It is one of the best of the mid-80s Twilight Zone episodes. I'm a big fan of that one.
Based on a short story by Richard Matheson, which was published in Playboy magazine in 1970.
Yeah, but what isn't?
Yeah, true.
So I thought, oh, I'll go back and watch some old Twilight Zones. And this disc had the classic Burgess Meredith episode where he loves reading and everybody hates him.
Yeah, that's the title, isn't it? I love reading and everyone hates me.
Everyone hates me.
Yeah.
And they hate him because he likes reading, but also because he's quite nebbish. And
he's Burgess Meredith.
And he's Burgess Meredith. But he goes through this whole post-apocalyptic thing, turns into the Penguin, invents umbrellas, so is my understanding, and then becomes a boxing trainer. So it works out fine for him in the end.
It's an amazing arc they used to get into those old Twilight Zone episodes, isn't it? Yeah, half an hour, and they managed to tell that entire story.
The entire story. It's really, looking at that episode, which was episode 8 of The Twilight Zone, it's a really primitive method of telling a story on television. It's like 55 years old, and it's amazing to see how far we've come with telling stories in a short form, and how easy it is to do that. And then I started thinking about something that you said on Box Cutters when we were reviewing Flash Forward a few weeks ago, about not needing to explain everything. How in Flash Forward they say, so we all fell asleep, but we weren't really asleep. But then and they say that like 15 times an episode.
Yeah.
And in an episode from 1961 that was also on this disc, entitled The Odyssey of Flight 33, a plane inexplicably starts gaining speed. And then they keep gaining speed until there's a big flash and a little bit of turbulence. They're not sure what it is. They think maybe they've gone through the sound barrier, but then why the flash? What's gone on? They're due to arrive at Idlewild Airport any moment, because it's 1961.
And JFK's not yet dead.
Not yet dead in the Twilight Zone.
Oh, spooky.
I know. And there's all this cloud cover. They can't get any coverage from radio contact. Any radio contact to any of the airports. They decide to just descend the plane down below the cloud cover, and are all shocked because they can see Manhattan Island. They can see Staten Island, the East River and the Hudson River. They can see New York, but there's no skyline. There are no buildings. They descend for a closer look, and that's when we see exactly what they see, which is a claymation dinosaur eating off a tree.
Right, so they've travelled to the studio of Harry Harrison.
Exactly, mm-hmm. Exactly. And
Harryhausen.
Harryhausen.
Sorry. Harry Harrison was the author.
Without even thinking about, oh my god, what's happened? Have giant dinosaurs descended from space and destroyed all of Manhattan? No, they just matter-of-factly go, right, so that whole boom thing, we must have travelled back in time, and now we're pretty much stuck here, but we've got enough fuel to go back over the cloud cover, try to pick up speed again, and maybe we can get back to our present. It's really that quick. There's no ifs and buts, no. It's just, oh my god, there's a dinosaur. This must have happened. All right, let's try it.
So you're arguing, this is curious, I was saying, you're arguing that that episode is better in storytelling terms than the Burgess Meredith one. Even though fans of The Twilight Zone usually count the second one as a poor episode, and the Burgess Meredith one as being a great example.
I love the Burgess Meredith one. The first time I ever saw it, I was blown away by the ultimate irony in it. Mm-hmm. And this is different for a Twilight Zone episode because there isn't an ultimate irony. It's just something weird happens, which did happen a little bit more later on in the series. It wasn't just about the ultimate irony. I like it in terms of what it can teach us about telling stories today. One of the things that the Burgess Meredith episode does is it explains things over. And it's about 15 minutes of television really jammed into 22. Airline one, well, it's also only 15 minutes of television. The first, 5 minutes you could just throw in the bin quite easily, entirely unnecessary. But just this one plot point, I think we can learn a lot from. Oh, it's this? Okay, let's move on and try to get on with it.
I mean, apologies for those who have heard this on Box Cutters before, but we were saying, when we were talking about Flash Forward, that thing where they repeat points over and over again, it takes everyone a very long time to get to the obvious conclusions. And my big problem is that if you advertise a show like Flash Forward, it's about people have seen the future. So then don't spend an hour for the people to work out they've seen into the future, which we, the audience, know from the ads. And we were saying you compare that to the recent Doctor Who story where they went to a parallel universe, where the Doctor's going, oh, how do I explain this? Oh, Zeppelin's over London. And the characters go, oh, we're in a parallel universe. He goes, oh, yeah. Well, yeah, we've seen it on telly. We've read it in comic books. Like, and it just gets rid of it because it assumes the audience will be intelligent enough to get it.
So what you're saying, John, is that in the ads for Flash Forward, they explain that they all go forward in time and they get a flash forward sense. And then what happens in the show is they keep talking about what happened to them, even though the audience already knows that. Yeah. And they keep explaining it over and over again.
Like that.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. But my point, and this is my point with I think you do have to work out what is the show about and also what does the audience know about the show, because you can't assume that your show is being made in a vacuum and shown in a vacuum. People are coming to watch any film or television show already knowing something about what it's about, which, again, with The Sixth Sense, just to go and film for a second, it's halfway through the film where, you know, he tells you he sees dead people walking around like regular people.
It was in the ad.
Which is in the ad. So you spend 45 minutes waiting for the film to get to the point that we actually know.
Yeah, well, you know, just start at the start of the story.
Mm.
We don't need all of that preamble, and I think in television that's really important. That I've been watching the remake of The Prisoner, and thinking about the original Prisoner, and they had the entire setup of the show in the opening credits. It's a very long opening credits, and it's, you know, unnecessarily wrong, but he's driving his car very fast, he goes to his office, he resigns, he wakes up, he's in the village.
Mm-hmm.
What happened? Well, that's what we're going to find out, people. That's what we're going to find out.
Let's not spend an hour getting there.
No.
So, I mean, to conclude then, are you saying that television storytelling is getting better or worse? I'm confused.
I think television storytelling is... In some respects, for the big blockbuster, the ones that are aimed at a low common denominator, they are getting worse.
Mm-hmm.
Because Twilight Zone was a popular show, it was easily understood by anybody. They were watching, and the thing is, every story was different. The only thing that brings them together is they all occur in the Twilight Zone. Something weird is going to happen in this episode. That's all you need to know. And then you just go with it. I think what we're doing at the moment with these mass market television shows is reducing people's willingness to suspend disbelief and just hitting them over the head with a premise time and time and time again, so that they just go, oh, okay, well, it's the premise of the show. If I don't like the premise, then I must be stupid. No, if you don't like the premise, maybe science fiction isn't for you. Maybe drama isn't for you. Maybe comedy isn't for you. You know, find something that you like. But if you can't believe that a plane has gone back in time due to some strange increase in speed...
Then get out. I've got to say also, if you watch those DVDs that have come out of the original Twilight Zone... Gorgeous cinematography, beautiful, crisp, black and white cinematography,
yeah.
And partly because it was low budget, it just so spare. There's nothing extraneous in that show. It's really amazing.
Some great lighting, some excellent casting, and it's really interesting to see in the later episodes, Rod Serling just kind of appear on set.
So he's walking around the corner from stuff going, hey there.
Yeah, so in Flight 33, we see the whole setup, and then about 5 minutes in, Rod Serling just comes out from the side. And says, yes, I'm on a plane. So are you. Imagine in the Twilight Zone.
Imagine how Rod Serling's wife must have felt every morning. Like, go out the kitchen. Oh, my God, Rod Serling's here. Like, yeah, you'd be freaking out. Something bad's going to happen.
Stop narrating my breakfast.
My children have turned into dinosaurs. If I want to hear more of your talking about the television form, where would I go?
Boxcutters.net.
Yeah.
It's a website where we have a podcast.
Oh.
You, me, Brett Cropley.
Okay. And we should also say this is the penultimate episode of season one of the Outland Institute. So if you haven't got on board the podcast train, it's time to do so, because when we go off air, we're going to be doing all sorts of intriguing and interesting new things with the podcast form. So make sure you enjoy that. And as I have enjoyed you, Josh Canal.
I have been enjoyed.
Sounds filthy. And you're back with the Outland Institute, the pop culture show on Joy 94.9, the only pop culture show which has Narelle Harris fiddling with her iPhone.
I know, I've got a list on it, and I have a poor memory, so my iPhone's remembering things for me today.
I miss paper and biros.
I know.
Biros, no one talks about biros anymore. It's all iBiros.
Today, in the spirit of Christmas, since it's coming up, or in the spirit of, as I like to celebrate, the summer solstice.
I thought it must have already happened because the Maya Christmas parade happened weeks ago.
I know, and it's like, you know, I think the decorations were up before the Melbourne Cup this year.
October, they put that big tree up.
Like, I think what they really ought to do is just leave them up after Christmas is finished this year, so we'll be well in time for Christmas 2010.
Young people today. But anyway, so yes, we're we're coming towards Christmas or Kwanzaa or Hanukkah or the solstice, insert whichever appeals.
Yeah, but it's a lovely thing for us to sort of coincide the time when we're going to get gifts for either people that we love or the people we have to get on with or this because we have to because we're related to them.
Mm-hmm.
To get some
Santas.
Yeah, all that sort of stuff. And I thought, well, perhaps it would be a good opportunity to do a little bit of a book roundup for the listeners of some suggestions and ideas for what to get their loved ones.
So
this year.
What should I be purchasing? And also going to ask, how have you come to this highly scientific list?
No, the highly scientific list is partly based on books that I've really enjoyed throughout the year, partly based on the guests we've had throughout the year, and partly friends of mine who write books that I think you should read.
Fair enough.
Really?
So kick us off.
Kick us off. So I tried to do a little... a few subcategories to help sort of cut it down. The first one is not written by a friend of mine.
Okay.
I have to say. Not an enemy either. I just never knew the chap. But I would suggest going out and finding Breakfast at Tiffany's by Truman Capote.
Oh, okay.
This is basically because I think but people should always have a go at least once a year, try and read one of the classics.
Mm-hmm.
I try to every couple of months pick up one of the classic books that I haven't had a look at before. So I picked up Breakfast at Tiffany's a little while back and was charmed. And I just found the writing so elegant and lovely, and it was so much more interesting than the film.
It is. And it's a novella, isn't it? So it's
yes,
a breezy
it's a novella.
Read.
And there's a second, there's a Penguin edition out, which is, I think, one of the $10 Penguins. So it's, it's an inexpensive stocking stuffer if you're required, or if it's Secret Santa and you want to help with improve the mind of
and
whoever
you're buying for. And with these $10 Penguins, are these the ones with the traditional Penguin covers?
The orange and white covers with
so
a little
you
Penguin.
So you could sit in a cafe and read that and you'd look fabulous.
You would. Look fabulous, you would. Mm. So that was my first suggestion. I've also just finished reading On the Road, the Jack Kerouac novels, and I wouldn't say that I enjoyed it especially, but I found it fascinating, certainly. And
that's Jack Kerouac's post-apocalyptic thriller, isn't it?
That is the one. Yes. So that's for a start. So for your classics, Truman Capote or Jack Kerouac. Now, obviously, as a writer of vampire fiction. I think there should be a couple of vampire books on the list.
Okay.
This is obviously in an act of shameless self-promotion. I would like to recommend that you get The Opposite of Life for your loved ones.
Who is that by again?
That'd be me.
Right, so buy your book for your loved ones.
Yeah, it also expresses...
Hello,
Media Watch. And look, it would express, as your listeners, a little bit of love for me. Sophie's already, done that step. Hi, Sophie. Thank you very much for that. But other vampire fiction. Again, going back to the classics, if you've not read Dracula, you should go back and get Bram Stoker's Dracula to see what the fuss was about. It wasn't the first vampire novel of the Victorian era, but it was certainly one of the most successful, and so much has sprung from that. So I think that would be, if you have a family member who perhaps loves Twilight.
Yep, so vampire-loving Annie Vi, for example.
Dracula. Yep. She may only have read about the Cullens.
Or The Opposite of Life by Neil M. Harris.
Or that. Possibly also, because I do have a lot of choices of vampire fiction because I read quite a lot of it. Mm-hmm. Let the Right One In. By John Lindquist. It's been made into a film and is being made into an American film now. I found the book magnificent. So again, and quite different again to the whole Twilight romantic vampire thing. So,
and if you've watched the film, because I must admit I wasn't a huge fan of the film, but I've been told the book is better again.
It's wonderful.
There's more.
There's so much depth and texture, and it's a very beautiful book, and also more horrifying. And the scene with the cats actually works better in writing, I felt.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't know what that means, go and buy the book, find out. And my last vampire recommendation is also my first ebook recommendation.
Mm-hmm.
You'll remember the lovely Mary Borsellino, who's been here. She is writing a series of young adult novels called The Wolf House, available as ebooks, and they're full of hot, sexy, queer teenagers being vampires or hanging out with vampires and having terrible, terrible times, and it's wonderful.
That sounds kind of cool.
They're fantastic books. So number two is out. There'll be a series of, I believe, six eventually. But yeah, go and to thewolfhouse.net. And
are these sort of young adult or adult books?
Young adult, but like I said, full of hotness and sexiness and death and.
What do I get with an ebook, by the way? I've never actually purchased an ebook.
With the Wolf House books, you basically you just get a file.
Okay.
So you can download it in one of six, I think it's five or six different formats. I download them as PDFs, and I have them hit loaded on my iPhone, but you can also just read them off your computer screen, or if you're really feeling that you've read enough of your Facebook online and for some reason that means you can't read books online, print it out It's quite simple, but it's a wonderful, wonderful series of books, and I think you should all go for it. They're only $4, so they're very inexpensive. So as a stocking stuffer, you could download the PDF, put it on a lovely little USB stick.
Oh, that's nice.
And then pop it in somebody's stocking.
I like that. And you could fill up the gap on the USB stick with podcasts of the Outland Institute.
I think that's a wonderful, wonderful idea.
Yes. That's lovely, actually. It's really good.
Yeah, so we're very well organised.
So that's Arnie Vise done. What's left?
One of the best fantasy books or series of books I've read this year is a series by a lady called Liz Williams. Now, we haven't discussed her on the show at all, so this is out of the blue for everybody. The first book in the series is called Snake Agent. They're very odd books as fantasies. They're actually a science fiction, fantasy, police procedural horror combination. So we have Detective Chen in a futuristic Singapore 6, because the city has now been franchised. At a period of time when the walls between heaven and hell and earth have become very thin and weak, so there's lots of gods and demons and stuff moving back and forth across the lines constantly. Chen's wife is a demon who's escaped from hell, so she's trying to lead a nicer life. And he keeps getting involved. He ends up with a sidekick, a partner, who is another demon. There are a lot of Asian characters, Chinese mythology, Indian mythology, so it's a much less Anglo-focused series than most fantasy books are. Very lively, very entertaining, funny, adventurous. I really, really love the book. So there's been, I think, 3 so far. But you start with Snake Agent, and they're some of my favourite fantasy books this year. And, of course, generally, if you know somebody who likes fantasy, you can rarely go wrong by getting them Neil Gaiman of some description.
Mm, yes, that's very true.
So, yeah. In the crime thriller section, again, one of somebody I personally know and like, but I actually read her books before I met her, Lindy Cameron's crime thrillers. She also does true crime books. And for full disclosure for Media Watch, I have got an essay in the most recent copy of Outside the Law, which is Outside the Law 3. But she's also got these fabulous crime thriller stories. There's her Kit O'Malley series, I'm at the moment reading Blood Guilt, one of the Kit O'Malley stories. And there's also Redback. Now, both of these books have lesbian protagonists, really tough, strong, funny, really, really great female characters. And they're a good fun read, and if you like a good crime detective story, the Kit O'Malley, Blood Guilt, and the Redback is actually more of a Matthew Riley thriller kind of thing, and they're really, really good books. So go and search those out and support an Australian author as well, which is another one of my secret agendas, or perhaps not so secret.
I think traditionally with a secret agenda, it's important not to tell people what it is.
Oh, I keep getting that wrong. Mm. young adult novels. Now, I've already mentioned Mary Borsellino, but I recently read a book by Justine Labalestier, who's an Australian author who resides in the US. Her book, How to Ditch Your Fairy, is a fabulous young adult novel. Again, really robust, vibrant language, really great ideas. It's really nice and refreshing to read a book in which there is such a vast array of characters of different ethnicity and sexual persuasion and all that sort of stuff. So it's a very lively but really marvellous sort of cast of characters, and just a lot of fun. There's a real Australian voice. With How to Ditch a Fairy, the lead character, Charlie, who's a girl, who's sports mad and is at a school for all these people who are all completely sports mad. There was just this little sense I had, this little microcosm of a view of how Australia is a little bit sports mad, and we tend to forgive our sports heroes anything because they're our Warnie or they're our whatever, and we don't seem to hold them to any kind of moral or ethical accountability. So there's this, that little frisson of discussion with that. But it's just a good, fun book. And I highly recommend her. And she has a new book out called Liar, which we did discuss earlier in the season, about the controversy with the cover of that book. So that's just been released in Australia with its non-controversial cover of the word liar in red lettering. So that's recommended. Mel Benalia is my next list, which pretty much is Arcade Publications, who we've recently had on talking about the books that they do. So there's the Madame Brussels, this moral pandemonium, but they have a fabulous little set of books, and they're all kind of little pocket-sized, so they're small fun, neat, and either, again, good stocking stuffers or just that little gift for someone overseas who you'd like to perhaps introduce to your Melbourne as you know and love it.
I think also I'd probably recommend Wheel in the Wreckers Melbourne. So Wheel in the Wreckers, it's something like Wheel in the Wrecker.
Yes, it's I have that one at home.
By Robin Anir, and it was just because when we were talking to the guys from Arcade Publishing, I was thinking about her work as well, which is an amazing exploration in Melbourne. And when you've read it, there's that richness of walking around the city and going, this is where this thing was, and just, you know, it gives you another city to explore.
Yes. Getting towards the end of my little shopping list for everybody now, and I hope you've all been taking notes. Now, I didn't know what category to put this under, but I wanted to reiterate that Tom chose Look Who's Morphing. It was a wonderful book. It was nominated for numerous awards this year, and is still one of the liveliest, freshest, most entertaining books I've read throughout 2009.
Yes, we gushed over that one earlier. You will find, if you go back through the podcast, where we have an interview with Tom Cho, we were quite length to discussing it, and yeah, amazing book.
We were just very excited, weren't we? So professional. And then I'd just like to leave you with a broad recommendation that, you know, look for small independent bookstores, look for Australian publishers and small press. There is a small press based in Perth called 12th Planet Press, who did The Marvellous Horn, which we also covered this year. Their latest collection of short stories, The Book of Endings, just got a rave review from The Age. So you just need to Google 12th Planet Press. I think they've got a WordPress account. They're also on LiveJournal. Look them up. They've got new stuff coming out. So, you know, don't support Australian publishers just because they're Australian. You should support them. Support them because they're doing good work. And they are. They're doing some pretty amazing work this year. It's really good to see so many Australian writers doing really interesting things with fresh voices and the small publishers supporting and helping them to do that, to get out there. So go and pay attention. Go and pick up something you didn't think you'd like. Go and try something new. And if you're not sure you want to take the risk for yourself, give it to someone as a present. Let them take that, you know, that experiment to the end.
Well, that is an excellent list of recommendations. We will get that up on the website. If Google the Outland Institute against a WordPress site, and you'll be able to find all of those titles listed thereupon.
Excellent.
If I read more of your writing, Narelle M. Harris, where would I go?
You'd go to narellemharris.com.
Excellent. We'll see you next week.
Thank you. Merry Christmas.
The Outland Institute.
Very, very thrilled to have our next guest in. She's the first lady of Australian comedy.
Oh, get out of town.
I think you could call her. She's, of course, famous for everything from live stand-up. She's done television with The Late Show. She's been in films such as Cracker Jack and Bad Eggs. She's
all of that long time ago.
Best-selling book out, The Lucy Family Alphabet. That's 2008.
All right, that's slightly more recent.
Yeah,
that's,
try and back away from
okay,
that one, Lucy.
Okay, that's because I'd simply run out of options and thought, what else can I do now?
And you've undoubtedly seen her on TV, on stage, and even perhaps on the street, depending where you live. Judith Lucy, welcome to the show.
I'm at my most entertaining best when I'm on the street, I think you'll find.
Do you rant?
Oh, look, it depends how sober I am, John.
How sober are you normally on the
street?
Well,
you know, it depends. If it's later in the night, I mean, I do remember, you know, there's nothing like getting off your rocker with a friend and just singing, you know, say New York, New York as you're wandering down Ackland Street.
That's nice.
I did see Liza Minnelli. Did you see Liza?
I did not. I would have loved to have.
You're lost.
Inside me. I know.
We're never going to have that opportunity again, John.
No. Although, you know, I
was amazed that she made it to the end of the show. I frankly.
They might reanimate her. You never know. I think, yeah. If anyone's there for potential zombie reanimation, it's going to be Liza.
Back off, Miss Minnelli. I'll tell you now, when she sang Cabaret, New York, New York, there wasn't a dry eye in the house.
Anne-Marie Peard wrote a great piece on her blog, the Theatre Reviewer, saying basically, yeah, she's too old. No, she can't sing them. It was the best night ever.
Like, exactly.
It's this great piece.
There was so much love in the room. It was just it was that old-fashioned showbiz, which I am just a sucker for. And you know when she said things like, you know, most of my family and friends have gone to the choir, so you are my family. You kind of believed it. Kind of thought, yeah. And at the end of the night, you really just, because she at the very end, she came out just sort of wearing a t-shirt and little socks, and she took her false eyelashes off and wiped away her makeup. Sure, her face still looked weird. There's no getting around that. But you just wanted to give her a little cuddle. You wanted to take her home and make her a bovril and say, Liza, Liza, forget about the hip replacements. Forget about the life-threatening illnesses. Stop. Forget about all the gay men you marry.
That's what I was thinking. Just, stop marrying the gay men.
Just, you know, as her mother did before. Yeah, so
family
a little,
tradition.
Very much so. But no, it was a tremendous evening. And I'm off to Fleetwood Mac. on December the 1st. So yeah. I tell you what, there's no stopping me.
Cutting edge.
The closer they are to death, the more I want to see them. The weirder their heads look because of surgery. I mean, Stevie Nicks just looks like a Pekingese now, really, doesn't she? So, yes, very much looking forward to that.
That's brilliant. Now, all these showbiz stories, of course, is why we've invited you on today. We wanted to talk to you about the idea of showbiz and comedy career paths, which is, you know, because two of the things we're very, you know, very interested in here is sort of career paths and you know, career kind of goals. The other thing, of course, failure. Both of those things we're fascinated with on this show.
Well, failure I embraced some time ago. Failure I'll talk about until the cows come home. When you talk about paths and goals, that sounds like that I might ever at some point have had a crazy plan, John, and I never did. I've really just stumbled from one thing to another like a crazy pinball.
Well, this is the question. If I was, this is just, you know, my outsider kind of, you know, naive autistic artist look.
Sure.
Why not? If you look at American comedians, and the goal seems to be to become a film star. You know, you can eventually get to Hollywood. You can become, you know, the next
Jim Carrey,
Adam Sandler. I was going to say yours was better. If you're in the UK, the goal seems to be that you get to have a TV series. You can be a Ricky Gervais. You can actually, you know, do some really interesting stuff with the form and you know. In Australia, I mean, you've done radio, you've done television, you've done books, you've done films. What is the goal? I mean, for an Australian comedian...
Quite poorly, as I said to you off air at one point. I mean, most of those things I think you'll find... Well, let's just have a look at it. The last television show that I was on regularly was Axed. That was, of course, the Mick Molloy Show, which some people might recall is still often referred to as the worst piece of television to ever air on our screens.
Hey, Let Loose Live.
Well, I wasn't involved with that, but so I think you'll find the reviews for the Mick Molloy Show were far more scathing, and it's still referred to today. That's what I enjoy. Of course, the last time I did commercial radio, there's another sacking for you. Thanks very much, Austereo. Films, yes, Crackerjack, Bad Eggs, but I think you'll find Bad Eggs was, that's got to be 8 or 9 years ago, and this is a true story, John. The only film role I have been offered since either of those was when they were filming The Mask 2 on the Gold Coast. I am not making this up. They said, you know, she can do whatever she wants with the part, but as it was written in the script, I was to play the role of a small, lithe Pakistani man. That is entirely true. Strangely, I passed on that.
Really?
So, you know, thank God people still keep coming to see me live, and I wrote a book that did okay. But look, I mean, obviously, we've got a much, much smaller population in Australia, and it's a much, much, the showbiz scene is much smaller, and frankly, you know, you've got to have a few irons in the fire, because it's really rare that you can make, you look at most comedians, everyone's given everything a bit of a crack, really. Because we just don't have the population to sustain, you know, me being a film star. I mean, unless you're Eric Banner and you go over to Hollywood and you actually do something really great with your life. I did say to him, because he happened to be on Rove a few weeks back, gee, you must be kicking yourself that you gave the comedy up. That must be such a huge regret that you're no longer doing 15 minutes at the Star and Garter. He must just go, ouch.
So, but I mean, when you're hanging out in your comedy bars with all your comedy friends.
Oh, and we do so much of that.
Yeah. I mean, is there ever, do people, because it always strikes me in Australia that breakfast radio is the highest paid thing you can do.
Without question. And Sydney breakfast radio. Mm-hmm.
But surely no one aspires to that, do they?
No. Well, I certainly never aspired to it, which is just as well, or I'd be in a psychiatric ward now, or at least have moved to New Zealand. I must admit, when I started doing stand-up, and I'm going to sound a bit like grandma comedy here, the thought of just doing stand-up and making a living out of that seemed pretty damned exciting to me. I kind of think it's much more prevalent now that people think, you know, you'll do stand-up for a couple of weeks and then surely you'll get your own chat show. So what I'm trying to say, John, is that I went in with very low expectations. In fact, that's really my attitude towards life, full stop. So anything that's come along, I've been quite grateful for, really. And I certainly never aspired to be on commercial radio. But, you know, you do give everything a crack. And when they said, you know, and this is how much money you'll be earning, I thought, yeah, maybe I could give that a go. And at that stage too, I mean, a lot of people that I respected had done commercial radio, people like Martin Malloy and, you know, Wendy Harmer, I have a lot of respect for, and Andrew Denton. And so I thought, oh, no, I think you can do commercial radio and not actually sell your soul to the devil. But I was quite wrong.
Now, you were at, was it Today FM?
At Today FM, which is Fox FM in Melbourne, the equivalent.
Right,
yes.
In Sydney.
The chick station.
How long were you there for?
We did breakfast for a year as the ratings just continued to plummet. And I must say, the thing that's different about Sydney too is that, I mean, if it had been a disaster in Melbourne, it would have pretty much just been reported, you know, in the Green Guide or, you know, whatever, the showbiz pages. Whereas in Sydney, I was slagged off everywhere from, of course, you know, whatever their equivalent of the Green Guide is, to the main body of the newspaper, to my personal favourite, the real estate section.
How did you make it into the real estate
section? No wonder Lucy's only renting in Sydney. It was really quite extraordinary. So, because we came in after Wendy Harmer, who had been tremendously successful. And, we really just took that jewel in the crown, as they kept telling me it was. And I turned it into a bit of an egg carton with a bit of silver foil on it.
But apart from the ratings, though, I mean, were you happy with what you were doing? Or was it, you know, were you producing a show that you thought had merit?
You know, it's extremely hard for me to say, looking back. The only period I enjoyed was 6 to 9. I loved being on air. It was great working with Kaz Cook and Peter Hellyer. We had a fantastic producer, Emma Moz. And in our own little bubble, we were quite happy. And, yeah, you know, we were reasonably happy with what we were doing. But the thing was, I mean, it's just quite a tedious story, which I managed to turn into a show. But, you know, we had like three different program directors in a very limited amount of time. It was kind of one of those things that when they hired us, they were like, well, of course, we know this is going to take time and, you know, these things always do. And Wendy had been here for 13 years or something. The first time we got bad ratings, it was like, you know, just blind panic. And so there were so many changes over a relatively short period of time, from, you know, the music we were playing to, oh, no, we just want it to be, we want it to be much more, which is what we wanted to do, like listener-oriented instead of celebrity-oriented. Oh, no, that doesn't seem to be working. Let's send Judith to Palm Springs to do a junket. I did the Ocean's 12 junket, where I got to, interview George Clooney and Brad Pitt. And, you know, I'll be honest with you, I kind of wanted to blow my brains out. This is the thing. I mean, you know, nothing against George, Brad. Obviously, we got on very well. I slept with both of them. It was...
As you would.
I'd be crazy not to. Andy Garcia, I said, no thanks. Matt Damon, I'd rather be friends with you, I said. But George and Brad, I said, bring it on. Most of them have got nothing to say, John, most celebrities you'll find. So, and I mean, that's your top of the range celebrity. So imagine interviewing, say, the people from Big Brother. And I can honestly say I would have had more fun picking nits out of a stranger's hair than interviewing most of those people. So that side of it I didn't enjoy very much. But actually just having a laugh on air with Pete and Kaz, I enjoyed a lot. And I loved talking to the listeners. But the thing was, we kept waiting to be sacked. But instead, well, they offered us the choice. They said, you can keep doing breakfast or you can move back to Melbourne and do National Drive. I reckon that decision took us about a second and a half. I mean, the sort of like going back to normal hours, moving back to Melbourne, doing a slot that was much more comedy friendly. So we did that. But then there was a certain person who worked for Austereo who was quite a supporter of mine, I think. And once he left, well, I think it was about 5 or 6 weeks after that, my delightful manager. I know I've got a manager, but even Coles has a manager, I like to say. He rang me up out of the blue and said, oh, I'm coming over. And, you know, he and I are quite close, but he doesn't normally drop over in the middle of the week. And I just knew it was bad news. And I remember opening the door and saying, how bad is it? And he said, it's pretty, used the C word with a Y on the end of it, and said they've sacked you and Kaz and they've kept Pete. But he did have a bottle of red wine in each hand. So, you know, he does know me very well. So, but to say we were not expecting it when it actually came is an enormous understatement. But thankfully, we only had two more shows to do that week, both of which I did completely drunk. That just seemed like the responsible thing to do. And then, I don't know, they replaced us with these guys, Hamish and Andy. And
whatever
I'm still
happened
waiting
to them.
For them to take off. Yeah, who's crying now on stereo?
So you then took that experience, though, and turned it into your live show, I Failed.
Indeed, exclamation mark.
Which I think was one of your most successful live shows ever.
Yeah, which is lucky, really, because, you know, if you do a show about failure and that fails, then, you know, I really would have had to move somewhere else, I think. But thankfully, people came along to that, which I'm very grateful for.
So what of your work? I mean, let's leave aside for a moment the idea of popularity, because anyone can be popular.
Can they? How?
What are the pieces you're most proud of? What are the bits that you felt you succeeded in what you wanted to do?
Nothing, really.
Really?
I don't think you ever think, well, that was just perfect. I can't improve on that. I may as well just stop and go back to being a sandwich hand.
I consider
doing that, by the way, but what I can do with a chicken schnitzel would make your head spin. Look, there are obviously some things I am more, I guess. Look, I mean, I guess my live shows and the book are probably the two things that, and you know, that's because no one can meddle with those things either, really. I mean, I had a magnificent editor, obviously, when I was writing the book. But television especially, you know, there are so many other factors involved. Film, obviously, I mean, God, it was so much fun doing both Cracker Jack and Bad Eggs, but they were someone else's words. And even radio, you know, unless you're on a station like this or Triple R, and they're the stations I certainly prefer to listen to, you know, people can tell you what to say. People can tell you how long it should be. So, I suppose I enjoy the things where I have the most freedom.
But, I mean, can you think of, do you get those single transcendent nights where you finish a gig and go, that was a really good gig? Does that happen? Or do you find yourself going, oh, I should have done that joke differently, or...
It's certainly a lot more common to walk off stage and go, gee, you become quite good at beating yourself up, I suppose. But, yeah, of course there are nights where you do walk off stage and think, you know, I had a really good time tonight and they were a lovely audience. That's as good as you're going to get from me, John.
That's the height.
Yep.
Why did you become a stand-up comedian originally? What was the draw?
From a very young age, outside of course, the rather predictable phase, being a Catholic girl that I wanted to be a nun, outside of that, I always wanted to be an actor. Yes, a wanker from a very early age. And so, you know, fresh out of school, oh, yes, having been the lead in the school play, The Miracle Worker. Ooh. That's right. I was Anne Bancroft. I had lines like, rats, rats, we used to play with the rats because we didn't have toys. Incredibly, NIDA rejected me, as did VCA. So I did 2 years of a BA at Curtin University in Perth, where essentially we just drank a lot of fruity Lexia and massaged each other. And then I thought, oh, look, I really wanted to go to VCA, actually, and I auditioned for them again, and I got sort of fairly close to getting in, and I thought, surely if I move to Melbourne, they'll have to take me. And subconsciously, I now realise I was also going, let's get as far away from my family as I can possibly get. So I moved to Melbourne, and I must admit, I did also have it in the back of my mind that it was kind of the comedy capital, certainly at that point. Yeah, VCA, dreadful audition. And then I had been seeing comedy. I think the first ever show I saw was Bob Down and Coralie Hollow, Mark Trevorrow and Gina Riley at The Last Laugh, with Peter Roseson as the DJ doing Pick a Hit. And I loved it. I just thought The Last Laugh was just this magical place, because there was certainly nothing like that in Perth. And then I started going to a lot of tryout nights. And, John, I don't know if you've been to a lot of tryout nights,
I've been to a few, Judith. Yeah.
Well,
I think you know
what the carnage can be like.
Yes.
And there are certain people that you get up, well, you watch them getting up and you think, sweet Jesus, surely I can't be as bad as that. So after watching, you know, these car wrecks for a year, I thought, I'm going to give it a crack. I was that bad, possibly worse. You know, when I tell you I do things like, you know, twirl a Cabana sausage above my head and try to recreate a documentary that I'd seen on Born Again Christians who dance with rattlesnakes in the deep south with a sausage that, of course, disintegrated as soon as I picked it up. Anyway, look, it was tragic.
I think that's brilliant.
Well, you would have been the Lone Ranger there, I think. I think the audience was generally mystified by pretty much everything I did, so, which was good because I think that distracted them from heckling me. They were just sort of silent and quizzical. physical. So did my first tryout at La Joke, and the rest, as they say, is history. Not really. I came so close to giving it up so many times. But yeah, I think I also was attracted to the idea of comedy because you can make your own work. And even when I, you know, desperately wanted to be an actor, I was always uncomfortable about the idea of maybe having to wait for the phone to ring. And I kind of like the idea of being able to produce your own shit, man.
It does seem to be part of the appeal of comedy is the control. You get to actually be, you know, in charge of it. I'm curious, I was watching Chicago the Musical the other night, and there's this line
in it. Why wouldn't you have been? And I saw that recently too, after I'd seen Liza.
Roxy says, something about how we all became performers because our parents didn't love us enough. Isn't it? And not just you, darling. I want to tar every comedian with the same brush. Do you think comedy is a thing people get into because they're trying to get some sense
the sad
of
clowns? Yes.
Yeah, well, I mean, do you think there is some truth in that, or is that just a velvet painting?
Crying on the inside. Well, of course, I am adopted. I've known nothing but rejection. So, wow.
Can I say, take that, Denton. He didn't get that. He tried to make you cry.
It was my mantra. As I was walking onto that set, I went, I will not cry, I will not cry, I will not cry.
Academically, though, do you think there's any kind of loss in comedians more than any other kind of...
Look, I know some comedians that are really well-adjusted, and I know some that are messes, and I know some accountants that are really well-adjusted and some who are messes. So I don't know. I mean, I suppose you maybe are likely to find more, you know, excruciatingly insecure people in the world of performance than you are in other fields. But, you know, I don't know if we're that much worse than any other profession. I mean, yeah, I know a lot of people. I know a lot of comedians who've had pretty screwy upbringings, but I know a lot of people full stop. I know very few people who have normal, whatever that means, families. And I mean, that was one of the nice things about writing the book, which was, of course, all about my childhood and crazy parents. I mean, the number of people, like, you know, when people have responded to the book, that's what they've commented on. It's either been, you know, my family was just as crazy as yours, or my family was crazier than yours. I want to go, it's not a competition. If it is, happy for you to win. But, you know, I think if people enjoy the book, it's because everyone can relate to having an insane family on some level. So I don't think it's just comedians. Mm-hmm. Not that we don't have our fair share of alcoholics and drug addicts, but you know.
But who doesn't?
Exactly.
Is there anything left that you haven't done? Like, would you like to do a mega musical like Gina Reilly, or is there any other kind of form you'd like to have a go at?
I'm a little disappointed no one has approached me to do a reality television program where they just follow me around, because it would be fascinating. John, I'm just grateful for anything that comes my way, really. Do you know, if I could have been anything, though, it would have been one of those sort of, you know, hoofers. I would have loved to have been a singer and dancer. As it is, can't do either. But if you come to my shows, you'll know that most of the time I always do a song or a dance just because I can. And it's the only time I'll ever really get to do that. But yes, in an ideal world, I would have been a Judy Garland. I love all of that.
Thank you so much for coming in, Judith Lucy. We have a chance to see you hosting the Black Eyed Susans. Very exciting.
Perth, I tell you, you can leave, but there's always that crazy connection. But they're a great band.
You can't hide. They are a great band, though. They're a superb band, the Black Eyed Susans. They're performing at Thornbury Theatre on the 18th of December.
And it's a Christmas gig, so there's, I think, you know, there'll be dinner and, you know, roast turkey and all of that sort of stuff. So come along. Mm, come along and throw some stuffing at me.
And your best-selling book, The Lucy Family Diary. Lucy Family Alphabet. Sorry,
that's it. Near enough.
Is in bookstores even as we speak.
Oh, if it hasn't been sold out.
Thank you so much for coming in.
Thanks for having me, John.
The Outland Institute. So if you remember at the beginning of the show when I said we had just so much stuff for your ears, it turns out literally true. Too much stuff for your ears. Too much, in fact, to make one podcast. The podcast was just going to be way too long. So this is the end of episode 21A. Yes, the end of 21A. Please join me for episode 21B, in which you'll get to hear the rest of the show, basically. So Glenn Dunks will tell us about the best Australian films of the year. You'll hear Craig McLaughlin doing the best crime against pop we've ever had. Sorry, Adam C. And there's just too many shenanigans. More shenanigans than you can poke a stick at. I mean that literally. Go on, Get a stick. Get a stick now. Listen to 21P. Try and poke at them. See what happens. Yeah. So thank you for having joined us for episode 21A. Remember, you can contact us at theoutlandinstitute@gmail.com, theoutlandinstitute@gmail.com. It's definitive. And you can leave comments on our site at outlandinstitute.wordpress.com. You can also leave presents at Joy Melbourne in the city, if you like. And, you know, if you go to that website, there's actually a link there to a amazon.co.uk wishlist. I'm just saying, if you're interested in those things. My name is John Richards. Thank you for joining me, and we'll see you in the next bit, 21B.
And for more of the Outland Institute, visit outlandinstitute.wordpress.com. This has been another Joy 94.9 podcast. You can support Joy by becoming a member at joy.org.au.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.